Hi, welcome to the second part of the history of punctuation. So in the first part of the second part of the history of punctuation, I spoke about the late Middle Ages, scholasticism and minimal punctuation, then the art of letter writing, and an interest in elegance of language, especially Latin, or only Latin really. And then I talked about the humanists who continue that interest in Latin, fired and kind of pushed on by discovery of manuscripts, older manuscripts with more classical, with Latin that's closer to classical times, which they perceived as more stylish and more elegant. So, and with that came an interest in language and style and form, not just content, which brought about an interest not only in the boundary of a sentence, marking that, but in marking the constituent elements of a sentence. And how do you do that? Through punctuation. So that's why in just the 200 years, 15th century and 16th century, there is an absolute boom in terms of invention and development of punctuation. Signs themselves, new signs have been invented, or a new sign being invented by just putting together two previous ones, and the shape of the signs being standardized and the use of those punctuation marks for when they are being used, conventionally speaking, custom-wise. And I spoke about humanism, which is an interest in classical Latin, in stylish Latin and language, in editing too, finding the most original text, and or what you think is the most original text, and in expressing well, basically, an interest in rhetoric as well, in oratory, a new interest in oratory and giving speeches and being persuasive. So humanism, and I spoke about the printing press, which allows people to circulate texts quite quickly, a huge number of texts in comparison to what there was before when you had to copy things by hand, and a standardization of how something looks like, because if you produce 1,500 almost identical looking texts in one go, relatively speaking, and then you sort of spread that, you have the possibility to reach people in a completely different way compared to having a manuscript that you pass around or that needs to be laboriously copied by hand. I spoke about Aldus Manutius, or Aldo Manutio, the Venetian printer of the late 15th century, who was a superstar printer who changed the layout of a page, who invented Roman typeface, italics, who changed the shape of the comma to the one that we know today, a little hook, who invented the semicolon, and who used the apostrophe for the first time in his texts, in his printing, and who also, I think that was it, who also, kind of just as an aside, he was also interested in editing, as I have said, finding a copy of, let's say, Aristotle's De Anima or something that he thought was closest to the original. So that was, Aldus was also interested in that. And of course, also being able, that's what I wanted to say. Sorry, I've been talking for a long time. He was developing the technology, the promises, as it were, of the printing press. What can you do with that new technology? Which also included cutting really complicated shapes. So if you think about us now, we can just change to have it in Greek, or we can download an Arabic or a Persian keyboard or whatever, or like typeface and use that, or do like weird alien kind of things, and that's all in this little computer thing here. But
500 years ago that needed to be cut, that needed to be that needed to be produced manually, physically, in quite tricky ways, because you have to have different molds, and then what kind of lead do you use, and what do you mix it with, amalgamation and whatever. So Aldous was also experimenting with especially, you know, readable Greek and beautiful, beautifully shaped Greek texts, and how to print that. That's a whole different ballgame from Latin, right? And then in the early 16th century, you have, for instance, huge Bibles, huge, massive folio Bibles, where you have, I think, Hebrew and then Latin and then Greek, for instance. And maybe in the bottom, I think there's actually a Spanish, a Bible printed in Spain, where you have seven languages. I have to check it out again, which includes Aramaic and then probably Armenian or something like that. So you have, that's just an insane, unimaginable piece of work for that time and for any time, really, in getting together those texts and getting together those typefaces and arranging them on this, on the page. None of this is self-explanatory. None of this should be taken for granted. That's just like us today experimenting with the internet and horizontal or vertical kinds of, you know, experiences of the web page and scrolling and touch screen and whatever. These are all things that are being developed and that are historically emerging, just like punctuation itself. And these were, you know, feats of intelligence, I suppose. So we've talked about the semicolon, the comma, and the apostrophe. Another sign, so some other signs that I said that were revived from sort of the late Middle Ages were the exclamation mark and the question mark. One was invented, my very favorite mark, because my research is mainly on brackets, actually, parentheses, which I think is the queen of punctuation marks. So the parenthesis as an insertion of parts of a sentence or a word even into a bigger sentence, that, I guess, activity or that phenomenon was around for 2,000 years. So Quintilian, a Roman orator and stylist or rhetorician, would write about parentheses as insertion when you are telling a story and then you tell another story inside of that story. Or when you have a sentence and you insert another little sentence or a clause or a phrase or a word or something into that sentence without, I mean, you do interrupt it, but mostly you don't change the flow, and it kind of still makes sense. But there was no sign for that. Romans didn't need it, but they knew of it, as it were. They practiced it without having a sign to mark off what has been inserted. As we have said, as we have discussed, the humanists or I don't know, sort of scholars, even today, we just want to make it easier for us to read. We want to read something faster, in the blink of an eye. Our eye is supposed to catch it, rather than to, you know, dig around in the text to find something and to make meaning. We want to be able to read things fast and understand fast. So it would be quite useful to be able to demarcate an insertion into a bigger thing, because then you can hold it in your mind easier, right? In a more, yeah, more easily. So there's more disambiguation, because maybe if we didn't have brackets and we were inserting stuff all the time into main sentences, we would get confused, because, you know, maybe the meaning bleeds out, as it were. You know, we wouldn't be able to know, well, what is the insertion now and what's the main sentence? And again, it would complicate writing and it would slow us down and be an obstacle and a hindrance, and we would stumble across the whole text. So humanists, letter writers, people who were communicating more and more through text in the 15th century, 16th century, needed more signs to disambiguate meaning. And so that figure of speech, as it were, or that practice of inserting, was finally became kind of graphically recognizable through parentheses. And again, we have a person that is properly inventing the sign in order to address a kind of need, right? You don't just invent something out of nowhere. Yeah, there's a need to have that. And if it catches on, that means other people have that need. And so in 1399, Coluccio Salutati, the mayor of Florence or something like that, or a Florentine politician, he wrote a text called De Nobilitate Legum et Medicinae, so of the nobility of the law and medicine. And that was the kind of dialogue, which one is better. And I think he said law is more noble, or law is better, or whatever. This was in 1399, and this is the first evidence of brackets to mark off that you insert something in a bigger sentence, and you might take that insertion away and the sentence still stands. And how did that look like? Well, it wasn't something that we would recognize as brackets at all. It was the left side was sort of a L shape, just upside down, and the right side was a caret, or I think it's called chevrons, but just one part, which is like an angle. So you can have, right, we have round brackets, we have square brackets, we have curly brackets, also called braces, and angle brackets. Basically like a V, just horizontal. So Salutati entered these two signs, this upside down L on the left and the horizontal V on the right, to open and close the bracket by himself into a text that his secretary had written for him, he probably having dictated that text. So he himself adds that, like Petrarch, he himself adding punctuation even a year after the first draft. And that is, I think, crucial, because there's a definite case that we can make for punctuation being accidental, getting lost, being inserted by somebody else, not the author themselves, maybe not even a printer, maybe 200 years from here. Firstly, I think all of these instances are valuable and valid and can be thought about, because a person has done something, or something got lost. Well, why did it get lost and how? But here we really have the proof of punctuation being important, and of the person themselves who's come up with this text, with this thing, adding them afterwards quite consciously. Now, I have tried to follow this text, De Nobilitate Legum et Medicinae, but I haven't quite been able to see how it sort of finds its way into printing, or how it maybe spreads the bracket as such, because obviously people must have realized, oh, this is a parenthesis, right? Or somehow the word must have gotten out. What is this even? Because it's all very well that Salutati invents that and uses that, but if nobody knows what it is, well, what's the point? So somehow there must have been a translation of that sign marking off the insertion to a sign that people are using and that they're realizing and recognizing, as it were. And I think sometime in the 15th century, I think it was 1420s or so, there is a treatise on punctuation by an Italian scholar called Barditta, who talks about parentheses, and who, I think even he says that they should be round. So there is a change of shape already, and I mean also a smoothing out of the shape, because it's a little bit tricky to have two differently looking signs to mark as one shape, right? Although I guess maybe Salutati wanted to make really clear, well, here's the beginning, the upside down L, and here's the end, the little V, the horizontal V. But I guess people quite quickly realized, well, it makes more sense if those two signs look the same, but are just convex and concave. So are kind of literally holding, visibly holding the thing inside, in the hands, as it were. So that happened quite quickly. But still, from what I have read, parentheses weren't like super spreading in manuscripts in the 15th century. So the key must then have been that they found their way into printing, because through printing, that it's an explosive spreading and kind of standardization and circulation of both the mark itself and for what it is being used and the shape of it. And the mark also found its way, so parentheses found their way into manuals for writing well and reading well. For example, Erasmus De Recta Pronunciatione, so how to pronounce Latin and Greek. I think I made a mess of the Latin, which was first published in 1528. That was also a manual on how to write well, as it were. And Erasmus talks about the bracket and says they look like lunulae, so little moons. Again, that shape, the beautiful, very delicate image of the shape. And then in his 1536 edition, he actually puts in bracket, because he's just mentioning them, but he hasn't put them in yet. This is kind of a moment of actual invention, very similar to the semicolon. There has been a need for more marking off, for more signposting, as it were, and that need is being addressed. And then it's kind of a adventurous story how that need seems to have also occurred in other people. So that that mark is actually being taken up. A friend once said to me, how do trends happen and occur? And she was at a concert and somebody suddenly in front of the stage started to dance really crazily, like weird kind of ska flinging of their limbs. And it looked weird and hilarious because it was just this one person. But then the person next to that person started dancing like that, and suddenly everybody was dancing like that. And that is just such an interesting phenomenon, because the first person who does something and who invents something is most of the time not actually the important person, but the second person who is imitating, right? And who makes what is weird and crazy normal or conventional or customary or something. I guess it's something we can say for lots of things in life, including punctuation. So there was the story of the parentheses. Now, two other marks I want to talk about, which are ellipses and quotation marks, because again, the story is quite a longish one, that it's not clear that those marks would make it or not make it. For example, in the second half of the 16th century, I think he's called Henry Denham, who was a printer himself, tried to introduce the percontation mark, which is what you would use to signal a rhetorical question. Right, so now you would be using it, right? Right, percontation mark. And that was a reversed question mark. So the belly of the question mark, as it were, opens to the right rather than to the left, that it usually does. But this didn't catch on. So apparently there was no need I'm not sure whether people at the time were already using exclamation mark and followed by a question mark, or the other way around, to signal a rhetorical question. That is something actually that I have to find out. But the punctuation mark to signal that rhetorical question, or maybe potential tone of sarcasm, that didn't catch on. There might be manifold reasons. Maybe Denham's texts weren't, you know, staple text. Maybe if it had been in an Erasmus and people would have read it all over the place, it would have caught on. Maybe if some grammarian had written about it. Maybe if it would have been taught at schools. But maybe also that there was simply no need at the time to have it. Maybe we're going to come back to that mark for rhetorical questions later, because there's something about the tone that we want to capture. And if one looks at the marks that were developed in the Renaissance or in those 200-300 years, well, we have something like the apostrophe or the semicolon or the parentheses, which are more syntax-based, perhaps, or semantics-based, I suppose, to tell us to navigate our way sense-wise. But there's also the exclamation mark and the question mark, which introduce tone, right? So, and then once there is ellipses, which is the dot, 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 signaling hesitation, doubt, interruption, or trailing off, something like that. There seems, or the punctuation mark, so that rhetorical question mark, again, something about the tone of the voice or the feeling, which is not to say that a full stop doesn't have feeling or doesn't say something about the suppression of feeling, perhaps, as it could be in maybe Albert Camus or Hemingway. But those marks, like question mark and exclamation mark, finding their way into writing, really means so much in terms of capturing an experience and capturing the tone of voice and trying to give the reader a way to translate that back into their ear or their mind or their actual voice when they read out, right? So it's not just about navigating grammatically a sentence or a text, but it's also a lot about the feeling in the text and how can we put presence into dead paper and dead ink, right? So ellipsis is, I think, another phenomenon, super kind of complicated and manifold and used in lots of different contexts, but the dot, 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 which sometimes was replaced by hyphen, 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 but some kind of shape of three things, one after the other, whether it be a dot, 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 or a hyphen, 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 sort of looking like a dot, dot, dot. And, you know, only in the 20th century did we settle for dot, dot, dot to produce this hesitation, this trailing off, or this doubt or interruption. That came around in kind of the late 16th century. And again, it must have addressed a need. And Toner has written a wonderful, wonderful book about that called Ellipses, Mark of Omission, Marks of Omission or something like that, where she traces dashes and dots, so ellipses, across centuries, trying to see where they were first used. For example, in the 1590s and then 17th century, dot, dot, dot was primarily used in English literature in drama, where it would perform or signal interruption, where you have dialogue and then somebody interrupts themselves or interrupts the other. And the first occurrence of that mark in these terms, in those terms, is from 1588, an English translation of a Latin play, a comedy. You know, fast-paced, people interrupting each other, and a dramatic text. The question is, you know, was it written to be, was it printed to be used as maybe people reading it out, or the reader reading and then reading the interruption, right? Reading the performance. Again, you have punctuation mark doing way more than just, in quotation marks, signaling something about the sentence. The dots in a dramatic text signal performance, right? Or signal tone, or signal feeling, or signal mental state. So I think punctuation, especially ellipses, the dot, 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 coming to represent the mind in a textual way, starts around that time. Again, maybe coming from drama, but then also in the 18th century, moving into the novel. And it's very much in the 20th century, dot, dot, dot being used as a sign for us readers going into the mind of the narrator or of the person that whose consciousness we are inhabiting, if that makes sense. Yeah, and that was so. Interruptions were also signaled by dot, 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 or hyphen, 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 but also by dashes. I haven't been able to trace the exact history of dashes yet, but from what I understand, a dash as interruption, rather than maybe, I don't know, kind of change of thought, also came around at the end of the 16th century. The word itself being taken over into English at the time as well. And those two things, the dots, triple dots, and then the dash, relatively interchangeable. Again, it's a slow story of figuring things out as you go. So really there's no moment where we can say, well, this is it now, it's just dot, 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 and not dash anymore, or something like that. Maybe I should peep into the future, actually, because we now, with our texting habits, use a lot of dot, 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 right? I mean, look at Donald Trump and his tweets when it was still 140 signs, not 240 or whatever, or 280, I can't remember, the Twitter signs, characters that we can use. He would use dot, dot, dot to continue tweeting, but also to make some kind of insinuation. I remember tweets about Hillary Clinton, dot, 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 dot. That's not actually really ellipses anymore because it's too many dots. But, you know, trailing off, suggesting we are encouraged to have our own thoughts, which might be something completely different from what he intended, but, you know, expressing some kind of menace as well, deliberately withholding information so that you step into that gap as a reader and kind of spin it on wherever you want to spin it. So it's a very generative, actually, mark as well. It might seem like a mission, it might seem like breaking off and not really knowing what you want to say next, but it's quite suggestive because it allows you to just spin it on, right? Wherever you want to take it. And also I find quite interesting that when we text, and I think this was the case in Facebook, right? When you chat on Facebook, you have those dot, dot, dot when somebody else is typing. And they, of course, I mean, with WhatsApp, sometimes I think you have like typing dot, 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 where it actually says, I don't know, Max typing dot, 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 right? And those three dots create a lot of anxiety, especially in terms of romantic relationships when we text with our partners or whatever. There are actual sociological studies on how those dots make us anxious and nervous because we see, for instance, that the person is writing a lot and then nothing happens, we get no message, and we ask us, have they been deleting it? Like, why are we not getting the message? Have they not just sent the message? So those dots actually make us anxious and nervous, and another interesting thing, I think, or sort of quirky information, is that there's always a time lag between WhatsApp texting or Facebook chatting and those dots. So the person might actually be off the phone for 1 minute, but the dots are still showing, and then the text is being sent. So it's actually not live, as it were. There's always a little bit of a delay. I think I need to think about this more, but I thought that was quite an interesting reuse of punctuation, which still, you know, the core tenor, the core, I suppose, quality still persists, which is waiting for something to happen, waiting for thought or expression, and doubt, hesitation, and potentially trailing off. Right, so the last marks I want to talk about are quotation marks, because they are key for making sense in a text and for having different levels of consciousness. You start to be able to tell where the narrator is, or which character is speaking, what they're saying, how, I suppose. So quotation marks, at least the concept of quotation marks, where you signal and flag up that this part here is from elsewhere, whether it be a text, an actual other text, or whether it be another person speaking, sort of boils down to the same, right? You signal extraneousness. You signal this is from somewhere else. And this is a very old sign, or rather, I don't know whether it's punctuation or more like annotation. This goes back to the Greeks and definitely to early Christianity, where you would have the dipple. That is basically this one V that I talked about in terms of the parentheses, the horizontal V. And people would use put the dipple in the margin to signal, for instance, in theological, ecclesiastical writing, this is a quotation from the Bible. And so this sign, I guess it was really around all the time, and I don't think it ever really went away, from what I can tell. It definitely migrated, because it went from the margin into the body of the text, and from there it became a little kind of comma shape, just the other way around, right? Not the comma with the belly to the right, but with the belly to the left. And then from the bottom it migrated up, and from being up it was doubled. So quite a long way that it went. By the 1570s, at least in English texts or printing, the quotation marks started to signal direct speech. Before that, they would mean quotation from another text. So, for example, you would have Thomas More quoting Luther or whatever, and then would put quotation marks at the beginning to the left to signal, well, at some point in the sentence there's going to be a quotation here. Then they also started to be used for wise sayings, for proverbs. For example, a rolling stone gathers no moss, and then you would put that, you wouldn't put that into quotation, but you would put a quotation mark, just a single one, at the beginning of the line, again, like with the quotation of Luther or something, to signal, well, here is something else going on, this is not from me, and this is authoritative. You would have an authoritative text that you quote, or you would have common sense, you know, wise sayings that are also authoritative because they stand the test of time. And from then, people start to use them as quotation for direct speech. There's a lot of ways that we can signal direct speech, and that people, you know, would do all of it at the same time. They weren't just waking up one morning and being like, oh, now from now on I'm going to signal direct speech with quotation marks. No. stuff was going on at the same time. So you people could just put commas and said, and put said he. For example, hello, said he, how are you? Right? That's very simplistic. People could put said he into brackets. So again, there's a bit more of a graphic kind of way of signaling that. They could put said he in italics as well, or they would do that. And they started to use quotation marks. But only in the early 18th century did quotation marks embrace the direct speech, actually. So that's a lot of time, you know, for a lot of experimentation. And, you know, it kind of makes sense. People weren't thrown by something new that they saw, and then they sort of made sense of that. There was also just dashes for direct speech on new lines. A famous example is Samuel Richardson, who wrote Pamela and Clarissa in the mid-18th century. Some of my favorite novels. I know lots of people don't like them. I love them. I went through the entirety of the 1,500 pages of Clarissa with joy one summer in my undergrad. And Richardson was both a writer and a printer himself. So he printed his own novels and literary work. And he would not put quotation marks, but he would put the direct speech on a new line with a dash at the beginning. Mind you, of course, reported direct speech, because he was writing epistolary novels. So somebody was quoting someone else, as it were, in a address to somebody. And from those dashes, from Richardson's text, that was widely read in France. It was like a kind of blockbuster novel. And that's why in French writing you have either guillemets, so that's chevrons, as they're called, the angle brackets, two of them, or you would have the dash, which is called tiré in French. And so these are more or less the signs that come up within the 200 years of the Renaissance, the 15th, 16th century. I mean, the Renaissance doesn't stop obviously there, but these are the signs that were available, that were around, that people were experimenting with, exploring how can they use them to best express in writing what they wanted to do, which was signal relationships in sentences quite subtly, pauses, tone, voice, feeling, performance, suggestions for performance, even just in your head, right? And I think a key thing here that is different from before is, well, okay, we have grammatical punctuation, rhetorical punctuation. We talked about, I think, in previous episodes how they overlap, and it's really hard to, especially for us nowadays who don't really learn Latin anymore, study Latin, to tell the difference between rhetorical and grammatical punctuation. And then another thing that that enters this nexus, as it were, this complex, is elocutionary punctuation. From what I understand, that is punctuation that you put in that doesn't actually have any grammatical point. So you would put that in because you would pause at that moment. But if I'm just reading a text and it's not a record of a speech, why would there be a need for a lot of pauses, a lot of commas? Well, that is because the person that wrote it wanted to record their voice, right? And so there's a kind of, in the 18th century, a renewed interest in the written or rhetorical, as it were. And there's an over-punctuation, as it were, because it becomes not grammatical and rhetorical, fine, but also elocutionary. So, and I think I'm also somebody who punctuate in an elocutionary way, if I can, you know, the laxity, the flexibility of English punctuation allows me to put a comma somewhere, because it's in the rhythm of my sentence in my head, I'm going to put it. But even though there might not actually be a need to signal a grammatical break here, or some grammatical relationship or something like that. So in the 18th and 19th century, there was a perceived over-punctuation. Maybe pushed on by a lot of grammars being printed and being read, and by an interest in standardization of spelling and language and making language less, I don't want to say impressionistic, but less a question of taste rather than a matter of actual language being a science, you know, and linguistics and philology coming up in the 19th century, where people think language is fixed, can be fixed, or is a, has rules. But punctuation in those treatises on language and grammar and rhetoric, punctuation always busts any kind of attempt at rule making and describing, because people always end up describing taste after all. They have lots of rules on the comma, and then in the end there's a sentence saying, well, actually, just do what you want, kind of. That's sort of the gist of it. And I guess that's a commonsensical and a true description of the situation, because language is alive, punctuation is alive, and I guess if somebody wants to put a comma somewhere to signal a pause, they have a right to do so, and if it's in their style, then no such thing as a rule, really. But that over-punctuation also meant that in the 20th century, people really cut back on punctuation. You have publications like grammar or style guides like Fowler's, Fowler and Fowler, publishing the King's English at the beginning of the 20th century, where they really cut down on punctuation and when to use it. Still being very rule-driven, but maybe also you have a sort of reaction against punctuation in literature. You have, for instance, E.E. Cummings in the 1920s, who just plays with punctuation and just really challenges us in terms of performance and pronunciation of his free verse. And you have people like James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, who are interested in, or Dorothy Richardson, or Richards, who are interested in stream of consciousness. So how can I represent the mind on the page, maybe without any punctuation at all, right? It's just one flow of words. So I guess we arrive in the 20th century with kind of pretty much a set of shapes and functions of punctuation marks and which kind. But what I want to mention for the 20th century is a change in technology again, because we have the typewriter coming up. I mean, that's a late 19th century invention. But interestingly, not all typewriters until the 60s would have all the punctuation marks. For example, the exclamation mark, which I spoke about in the episode on shape of punctuation, the shapes. Not all typewriters allowed people to do that, to make that sign. So what people would have to do is to put a dot and then go back again and put an apostrophe on top of the dot, so you have the exclamation mark. That could be because the typewriter had been invented for commercial uses, and most of the time in business communication you don't really need an exclamation mark. Again, there's a need or a lack of a need of something, and punctuation, its presence or its absence, signals that there is a need or there isn't a need for something. So you have the typewriter, but again, that's you can produce text looking very visible and like sort of very legible quickly. And then you have the Xerox machine. I think that came up in the 60s, right? Like 50s, 60s. Again, it's a bit like a printing press, where you can reproduce identical copies, lots of them. And this time, just you as a single person, as a lay person, by pressing a button. And then, of course, the personal computer and the internet. And I mean, here we are, that's something for another episode, digital talk and digital punctuation. But what I do want to pick out and come back to is the percontation mark, which was the mark from the 16th century, late 16th century, signaling a rhetorical question, the reversed question mark. Over the centuries, people, writers and thinkers have been trying to find a mark, a new mark, inventing it, making it common currency, failing to do so, to signal irony, to signal sarcasm, or a certain kind of tone, and to flag that up. Well, we kind of still want that today when we use emoji, a winky emoji, when we have mentioned something that could potentially be controversial or that could be misunderstood by the other, depending on the context. We try to still control how something comes across, because if we can't do it by speech, live, we definitely won't be able to do it by writing, where we don't have voice and tone and gesture and facial expressions, right? So in that sense, emoji are much like punctuation marks, trying to control meaning, written meaning, right? But for example, I think Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, mentioned, oh, there should be a mark signaling irony. And I think in the 17th century, there was an Englishman, a grammarian, proposing another sign. Again, I think it must have been an upside down question mark or something like that, to signal a rhetorical question. Irony, sarcasm, rhetorical question, that sort of all revolves around the same thing, which is a certain kind of tone, right? None of these things were really successful. Same as a 20th century attempt at a invention of a new sign, which was in the 1960s by Martin Spector, a public relations advertisement guy, who said, we should have a sign for a rhetorical question, because our times are so shocking and weird and fast, and you know, the feeling of a rhetorical question, how it sounds like, how you feel like when you say it or when you put it or when you hear it, it just captures the lack of orientation and shock, constant shock that we are in today. And so he proposed trying to find one, and there was like a magazine wide call where people could send in the suggestions, and in the end they actually just settled on a question mark superimposed with a exclamation mark, and that went down in history as the interrobang. Google it, you can find lots of things on the interrobang, because you know, right, it's like a bang, it's like that question. And interestingly, I think there is a Unicode for the interrobang, so you can make it on the computer, you can make it in certain typefaces. Although, and I think there are even typewriters from the 60s that have the interrobang, but it never really caught on. Again, we must have been happy with the set of punctuation marks that we have, and we must have been happy with the sequence of exclamation question, or the other way around, to signal the tone of a rhetorical question. In the 90s and 2000s, noughties or whatever we call them, there have been more attempts at finding ways to express sarcasm or irony. For example, sartalics, that is the opposite of italics, as it were. So italics slanting to the right, and then sartalics slanting backwards. Or that didn't catch on. Or the snark mark. So that is a man, an American, and his son inventing a kind of mark for sarcasm that they even copyrighted, and you can buy it for $2 or something and download it and use it. That's like a little squirrel or something. Didn't catch on at all, and they were made fun of a lot online. And what we do now, I suppose, is hashtagging. That's another way of commenting somehow. It's not really a sign because you have the hashtag plus something else, right? And it's a whole new thing. You know, you lift it on some kind of meta level. And you use another word really to signal. You can say hashtag sarcasm, hashtag irony, right? And basically telling us how you want it to be read. Again, that's not really punctuation, I suppose. That's some kind of other phenomenon of writing. So we still feel like we need something to disambiguate and to make sure that the other person reads it as irony and not what we really mean. But it seems that irony is bigger than us, and it seems maybe that we are quite happy to have that ambiguity, because it would be kind of boring to just have everything decoded in a sentence and in a written communication, right? So that was the second part of the history of punctuation. Super long, and the story is barely covered, but that was the kind of whistle stop tour through the Renaissance today, from humanists to digital communication, from the printing press to the typewriter to the internet, from more control what happens inside of a sentence to including feeling, tone, performance, representation of the mind through punctuation. Thank you for listening, and talk to you soon with some more specific episodes, for example, on religious punctuation or on texting and punctuation. Yeah.